We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Nick Whalen, Alex Barutha here with you. It is Monday, April 22nd. You are listening to the RotoWire Fantasy Basketball Pod. Plenty to discuss from a busy weekend full of game ones in the NBA. We got three games coming at us tonight: Orlando, Cleveland, Philly, New York, and LA, Denver. We'll dive in on all the action from the weekend and start previewing those game twos in a moment. But first and foremost, we're brought to you by a new sponsor, Prize Picks. You know about Prize Picks. We've been putting daily Prize Pick video content out on Twitter every single day. You can go check out the RotoWire Picks tool. A ton of great stuff over there to help you win money on Prize Picks. And Prize Picks is the best way to get action on sports in more than 30 states across the country. Prize Picks is so simple to play. I can make my picks, submit my entry in less than 60 seconds. You just pick more or less on two or more player stats and watch the winnings roll in. I'll tell you right now, Alex, Prize Picks is running a Nikola Jokic special tonight. All he has to do is score 1 point in this game against the Lakers, game two. And that is basically an automatic hit for you as part of that entry. So tack that on with one other one. I'm looking at Austin Reeves. I like the more on 18 points plus assists for Austin Reeves. Number's actually up to 19 now. I still like that. He's gone way over in each of his previous two games against Denver. I thought eerily quiet in game one. Took only 9 shots in 37 minutes. I think we see a more aggressive version of Austin Reeves tonight. So go fire that up. Make sure you get the Nikola Jokic promotion over on Prize Picks tonight. Quick withdrawals, easy gameplay, an enormous selection of players and stats are what make Prize Picks the number one daily fantasy sports app. Go download the Prize Picks app, or you can even play on your browser, on your computer. But either way, make sure you use our code ROTOPOD, ROTOPOD. That's ROTOPOD. That'll get you a first deposit match up to $100. You put $100 in, you get a free $100 to play with over on Prize Picks. Again, that promo code is ROTOPOD, ROTOPOD, for a first deposit match up to $100. Pick more, pick less. It's that easy over at Prize Picks. All right, maybe we'll talk more about some of our leans on these games tonight as it pertains to Prize Picks, Alex. You can also hear us on NBA radio later tonight, 7 to 7:30 p.m. Eastern. We'll be previewing all three game twos, but I want to back up and talk about what we saw over the weekend, Alex. We'll go in somewhat chronological order, at least to start. You know, we had circled Magic Cavs as the, all right, I'm okay maybe streaming this one on the golf course series. And through one game, that has held true.
Yeah, very low scoring game. You know, I'm in the camp that I thought the Cavs would win the series and maybe easily. And part of that was like, I think Orlando's going to have trouble getting to 100 points in a lot of these games. I just don't. It's just, and they didn't in this one. I forget what the final score ended up being. It was 97-83. And look, they left Jared Allen open for so many just wide open dunks in the middle of the lane. Yep. They clearly could not contain Donovan Mitchell. Darius Garland made some nice plays too, although he ended up with 5 turnovers. At some point, Banchero just in the second half was like, you know what? I'm just going to start trying to ISO, take some mid rangers because nothing else is working. So this ended up being a pretty defensive matchup.
Yeah, I mean, you're not going to win a whole lot of playoff games in 2024 scoring 83 points. This is not 2002. So I have some concern for Orlando. I think defensively is where you thought, okay, you know, you got to score more than 83 points, but you know, you're looking at this as, all right, you can hold the Cavs under 100. Maybe if you can just get to like 102, maybe that's enough. And you know, I thought they did some decent things defensively. Cavs didn't shoot the ball all that well, especially from three. They got almost nothing from the bench. You know, Niang, Okoro, Caris LeVert, none of those guys were really impact players. Sam Merrill came in for a little bit, didn't really do a whole lot to his part. It was really Banchero and Wagner were the only two guys who, you know, somewhat showed up for Orlando, which had just a terrible shooting night overall. I mean, 32% from the field, 22% from beyond the arc, even at the free throw line. They got there 30 times, which is great. But 19 of 30 at the line were the Magic. Banchero, 4 of 8. Jalen Suggs, 4 of 6. Was not a banner effort for Jalen Suggs. 4 of 16 from the field, 1 of 7 from 3. I was talking with our guy, Brandon Kravitz, who, of course, covers the Magic down in Orlando. And he just said, look, it came down to open threes. He's not panicking. He said, you know, hopefully those will start to fall. Does Orlando have the personnel, right? I mean, they were 5 of 23 on what NBA.com stats describes as wide open threes in game one.
I mean, they were I think they were dead last and made threes per game at 11.
Yeah.
And in the regular season, and they shot just 35% on those. So no, I mean, they guys can hit open threes. Like Gary Harris is going to be able to hit some. Suggs, yeah. Wagner, Wagner's been on a cold stretch, but yeah. No, I mean, if you're, this is why I thought this was a bad matchup for Orlando, because what the Cleveland Cavaliers are good at is packing the paint with Mobley and Jared Allen. And if you have to go inside, it's going to be a big problem for you. And they even have Okoro, who they can throw on some guys on the wing, who's going to give them problems. So maybe Orlando pulls out a game where they shoot hot from three, but that's how the Cavs are going to want them to win.
Yeah. Cavs 5.5 point favorites tonight for game two. Of course, that's in Cleveland. Totals all the way down at 203.5. If you look at the updated series price, Cavs minus 350 to win it, Orlando plus 275. I mean, I would be shocked if Orlando finds a way to win this game. And you know, I wouldn't say this felt like a 50-50 to me. I think you were a little stronger on the Cavs than I was. I was more on the camp of like, if I'm the Bucks or the Celtics, I would want to face Orlando just because this team has almost no playoff experience, at least for the meaningful guys on this roster. And certainly that showed in game one. What I will ask you is, does it matter who wins the series? Can either of these teams, whether it's Cleveland or Orlando, be anything but a sacrificial lamb for the Celtics in round two?
I mean, I think it's a better chance that this upcoming series would be competitive if it's the Cavaliers. They have more top talent. They're at least more interesting to me, partially because they're a better scoring team. They can at least potentially keep up with Boston on that end of the court. And they have, you know, they could try Mobley on Jason Tatum to try to bother him. It's still going to be a problem, obviously, when it comes to that. But because I could see that series going six. I don't think I'd see it going six if it was Orlando.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/BlueWire. Just go to Indeed.com/BlueWire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/BlueWire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
If you're a basketball junkie, then you know there's no better time of year than the NBA playoffs. Twice a week, J.J. Redick is cooking on his podcast, The Old Man and the Three. He has guys come on in all stages of their careers to talk about the league and share stories you won't hear anywhere else, including Devin Booker on why he talks so much trash, Ray Allen's epic free throw competitions with LeBron in Miami, and the moment Tyrese Halliburton knew Pascal Siakam would be a good fit in Indy. In addition to player interviews, every Monday, JJ breaks down the top three things happening around the NBA with unmatched analysis, not outlandish takes, and is often joined by masterminds of the game like Tim Legler to dive deep on rookie reports, trade breakdowns, and why is mean mugging now a tech? You won't find another outlet that covers the game as comprehensively and with such insight as JJ does it on The Old Man and the Three. Make this your companion podcast during the playoffs. Listen to The Old Man and the Three ad-free on Wondery Plus or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, let's go to Suns-Timberwolves. I don't have much to say about Orlando-Cleveland. Again, we'll have game 2 in that series coming up tonight, so we'll have more on that later in the week. One of the bigger surprises to me from the entire weekend, Alex, not necessarily that the Timberwolves won this game, but the fact that they won it by 25. I mean, we talked at length last week about the Suns being favored to win the series. They are now plus 125 to win, Minnesota minus 155. So, you know, we're not closing the book here. But this was an emphatic statement by the Minnesota Timberwolves, who actually trailed after the first quarter. Right? I mean, Phoenix came out pretty hot, put up 28 in the first. Kevin Durant played well, was not a great afternoon for Devin Booker. He was 5 of 16. Nurkic was quiet. You know, Brad Beal was relatively quiet. But the Timberwolves, if I was a Timberwolves fan, I'd be a little nervous with starting this series, just given, you know, the recent history. And there's not it's not a long list of Timberwolves playoff games, but it kind of felt like, man, we had this great regular season. We end up as a 3 seed. We play this team that arguably has more talent, that has Kevin Durant. And man, I don't know if I love this matchup. But I think this was a pretty much a best case scenario start for Minnesota, winning this game like it did. And, you know, even if they come out and lose game 2, you at least got your split. But I think Minnesota, and we saw this especially from Anthony Edwards in the second half. Like, I don't think Minnesota is aligned with the betting market. I think they believe firmly that they're the better team.
Yeah, Edwards was ridiculous, especially in the second half, like you mentioned. To me, you know, the two main things sort of define this game. Phoenix, I think, just kind of got stuck into their – they just don't run that much that's creative on offense. Like, they just run the Beal, Booker, Durant. We're gonna come off a pick. We're going to hang out in the 16-foot range. We're just going to take a shot. Maybe we hand it to Nurkic and we do some dribble handoffs. Like, it's just not creative at all. So you are – I think Phoenix, more than any other team – and I actually kind of hate the phrase make or miss league – but I think Phoenix, more than any other team in the NBA, is like the make or miss team, just because that's like the shot they get every time down the court. And then for Minnesota, they dominated the offensive glass. They had, I think, 13 offensive rebounds to Phoenix's 3. And that's great because you keep Nurkic off the boards, and Nurkic has been great for them all year. Gobert ends up with 6. McDaniels has 2. Conley has 2 even. So if they can continue dominating the offensive glass and just getting more possessions than Phoenix, that's going to be huge.
Yeah, I mean, you said it. Minnesota took 13 more shots. I mean, they out-rebounded the Suns 52-28 overall. Had 10 more assists on the day. I mean, this was a pretty thorough beatdown, and it was really the second and third quarters when Minnesota ran away with it. And I think you make a good point about the Suns offensively, right? And that's been a criticism of them all year. And I think in the NBA, where so many teams now play similarly, it's one of those things where it's like, unless you're looking for it, maybe you don't notice, but you really do notice it with the Suns. Like, when things are grinding to a halt for them offensively, they don't have anything to fall back on, right? And I don't know if that stems from you don't really have a true point guard. I don't know how much I believe that, because both Beal and Booker have so much experience playing on the ball. Obviously, you know, if you ask Kevin Durant to be a facsimile of a point guard, he could basically do that as well. It's like you have... It's not like you don't have a creator that needs to be set up, but I think you're right that they lean a little bit too hard into this one-on-one, my turn, your turn style. And, you know, Minnesota, in theory, has the defenders, right? I mean, Jaden McDaniels, you look at his lines, like, all right, 9.6 rebounds, 2 blocks. And then you see some of the supercuts of him, you know, chasing around Kevin Durant and Devin Booker. And you see why he's considered one of the better perimeter defenders and most versatile defenders in the NBA. I mean, Kevin Durant ended the day with 31 points, but you know, he had 5 turnovers. He was a minus 20. It was a hard fought 31 for KD.
It was. I mean, they're making him work. Phoenix, you know, they don't some other teams, you know, Milwaukee's kind of like this sometimes, where they don't do that much off ball. Like, you know, you think about, I mean, Steph Curry is a really high level example of this.
Good player.
But they're not running Durant or Booker or Beal off of these, like, you know, flying around, fake backdoor cut, like off ball actions all the time.
No.
Like sometimes Grayson Allen like flashes to the top of paint, tries to get it to work that way. But it's a little stale, and which is weird because not only is their offense kind of stale, they actually turn the ball over a lot. It's kind of been one of their main problems all year. And they committed 15 turnovers to Minnesota's 14. And at some point it becomes a math equation on possessions. If the turnovers are going to be similar and Minnesota's grabbing a ton of more offensive rebounds, then Minnesota's going to get more bites at the apple. And these teams are relatively close to being, you know, the same level of talent to where that would make me lean Minnesota if that's going to continue to happen.
So we'll get game two in this series tomorrow night. Minnesota right now, a 3-point favorite, totals at 213. Is there a case to be made that there's a buying opportunity now on Phoenix that we get this big swing in the series price, getting that plus 125? Like, is that enough juice for you to entertain it? Are you that alarmed by what we saw in game one?
I'm a little alarmed because I think if you're the Suns, you have to figure like this is how you would think this is how they lose, which is just we get crushed because we don't have enough size. And they still weren't able to defend it. I think it's still possible for Phoenix to come away with the series because the double-edged sword is these guys on Phoenix can get extremely hot,
right?
And they can make a ton of shots. And it always is, you know, if you like a lower seeded team in a series, really strong chance they lose game one. So if you want to bet on them, your best value is just going to be till game one's over and they lose the game. And then you can snap up a bet. So if you like Phoenix, if you liked them before, then I think there's reason you could put a wager down now.
Yeah, I mean, it goes without saying they need more from Nurkic. I don't know if that's coming. Yeah, you know, he's struggled against Minnesota all year. He's just they're not going to ask him to really do anything out of his way as a scorer. Everything he gets is going to be, you know, lobs or feasting on second chances, and those second chances just aren't really there against this oversized Wolves lineup. I think what's a little somewhat concerning, I think, if you're the Suns, is, you know, you could convince yourself on one hand, like, yeah, Devin Booker will be better. Beal will probably be better. You can basically pencil in the 30 from KD every night. But one, the rebounding discrepancy. Two, you know, Anthony Edwards had a great game, but I wouldn't say anybody else, you know, necessarily dominated for Minnesota, right? I mean, Mike Conley goes 2 of 12 from the field. Carl Anthony Towns did get to the line 8 times, made all 8. That was big. This was the best he's looked since coming back, but was still, you know, relatively limited, played 27 minutes. They did get a nice effort out in Nikhil Alexander Walker. He's probably not going 4 of 9 from 3 again off the bench. I think that's the big one. But with Phoenix, it's just, you get beyond that top 3, 3.5, and even Grayson Allen, you know, ended up getting banged up and left this game in the second half. Eric Gordon gave them nothing. And beyond that, it's like, you're going to see some Royce O'Neal minutes. He was actually decent for them. One of the only bench contributors they really got. I mean, in the playoffs, you can get away with having 6.5, 7-man rotations, but it's like, if Eric Gordon's cold, if Grayson Allen's cold, there's not another option, right? They have like 5 or 6 guys who've been in and out of the rotation all year, but it's like, who do you turn to, right? Eubanks, Thaddeus Young, right? Josh Okogie, Nas Little. Like, I don't think any of those guys are making an impact. And of course, we should say that's not the plan, right? Like, if we're talking about what can Josh Okogie bring the Suns, that's a problem. The way this team is constructed is you have 3 guys that have to win you the game.
Yeah, that's where I was going to go, was to point out the bench, because you mentioned it. Eric Gordon gave you nothing. And I don't know. I mean, they can't – this is not the series where they can go small. You know, they played Eubanks 9 minutes and Nurkic 27. And it's like, they can try, but Minnesota is always going to have one big on the court, whether it's Towns, Gobert, or Naz Reid. And yeah, like, Nikhil Alexander-Walker is – like, he's not going to be 18, 4 steals, whatever. But he's been pretty good for them all year. He has stepped up when other guys have been hurt for Minnesota. So it's not like he hasn't been playing. Naz Reid, 6th man of the year, top 2. He's going to finish. And they only got 5 minutes out of Kyle Anderson, who athletically, you know, this might not be a series trying to guard these guys. And he got hurt. But if he returns to the series, and he can play well too, it's going to be a problem.
All right, let's go to Sixers Knicks. This was our third game on Saturday. Knicks ended up winning that one 111-104. Concern here, I think, on a number of fronts for the Sixers, who are now plus 220 to win the series. Knicks minus 285 to win that overall. New York did not play well, Alex, in game one. This was a very winnable game for a Sixers team that also didn't play that well. But the Knicks shot under 40% from the field. They did start banging in some threes late in the game to clean that up a little bit, but they were missing a ton of looks early on. And we saw a very, very suspiciously aggressive version of Bojan Bogdanović, who was good for the Knicks. Like, their bench, you know, really outscored the bench units for the 76ers. I mean, Bogdanović was plus 27. Mitchell Robinson was fantastic, plus 20. Miles McBride, plus 37 in his 28 minutes. But I also, I mean, this was, we've watched a lot of Knicks games over the last couple of months, you and I. This was about as off as Jalen Brunson has been, especially in the first half. Just was not hitting. It was getting to his spots and just could not get those little 9-foot fadeaways to fall. Ended up with 22-7-7. I mean, that's just, he's kind of at that level now where even his bad games look fine. But that was, I think, as poorly as Jalen Brunson might play the entire series. And that's pretty concerning for me if I'm Philly, you know, knowing that you kind of got this gift where the Knicks didn't play that well. They didn't shoot that well. Brunson was off and you still end up losing this game. Now, obviously Embiid went out with what looked like a catastrophic injury. I actually had to go to a comedy show on Saturday night. So I was watching the first half. I had to. And I see Embiid go down and I had to leave at halftime to go to this comedy show. And I'm like, I'm telling my buddies, like, dude, did you guys see the play? Like, dude, I think Embiid tore his ACL. Like, this is crazy. And then I'm, you know, sneaking looks at my phone during the show. I'm like, wait, Embiid started the second half? Like, what is going on? He was laying on the floor for 7 minutes, not blinking his eyes. I mean, for one, coolest way I've ever seen a player get injured on an off the backboard dunk. Two, very happy that he appears to have dodged a major injury. But as we record right now on Monday afternoon, he's still questionable. I fully expect Embiid to play, but I don't think he's going to look like himself. I don't think he really looked fully like himself even before this latest scare. And perhaps even larger for tonight's game specifically is that Tyrese Maxey is questionable with an illness. Did not go through shoot around. Now, in the playoffs, I would expect someone like Maxey to gut it out, but probably not going to be close to 100%.
Yeah, not going through shoot around is not a good sign. I don't know if it's a fluids concern, you know, they're just trying to make sure he's hydrated. Yeah, I thought Maxey had a really great second half. That I felt like they turned the Jets up and like, hey, we got to get on a run on this Knicks team. We can't get stuck in the half court against them. Or that's going to be a problem. And you mentioned, man, the Knicks bench, Bogdanović started off with like a bank three and then was just cooking after that. He's like, that's it. I'm feeling it. I banked a three in. McBride was awesome. Mitchell Robinson got some nice blocks. This was another game where the rebounding, I think, told a huge part of the story.
Yep.
New York has 23 offensive rebounds to Philly's 9. Turnovers are about the same. One thing I thought was interesting about this game, like one play, I mean, Embiid was awesome offensively, but his main problem, I think, is on defense. He doesn't move very well. And I don't think New York exploited it that much, the fact that he's not coming up a lot on a lot of those pick and rolls and basically playing drop coverage. Yeah. I feel like maybe they'll go to that more. Another thing, too, is Philly was completely fine leaving Josh Hart open for like a huge portion of the game. Like, completely, when he was on the weak side, they would just pretend he wasn't even there. And he ended up with 22, but I don't think he was involved as he could have been. Obviously he was great. He was great on the boards and he hit some threes late, but they were kind of pretending he didn't exist, which I think New York will probably try to exploit this time around.
Yeah. It was a really weird game overall, like dramatic runs back and forth, right? Like Philly got off to a great start. They were up double digits early on. They were up double digits after the first quarter. Knicks outscored the Sixers 33-12 in the second quarter. Philly comes back and outscores the Knicks by 15 in the third quarter. And then the Knicks come back and win the fourth quarter by 10. I mean, a different team was leading at the end of each quarter, and you really kind of felt the runs and the swings of this game as it was going on. One thing that surprised me, Kyle Lowry looked great. I hate to say it. He's probably my least favorite player in the NBA right now. And I have a very short list of players that I don't like. He's on it. This was the best Kyle Lowry's looked in like 3 years. I mean, 18 points, 4 boards, 2 assists, played well in the play-in for them. I don't know what happened in Miami. That kind of felt like a pretty good fit for Kyle Lowry at this point in his career, but being back in Philly has unlocked something for him. You know, we talked on the NBA show last week about the Sixers needing like an unconscious game from Nick Batum just to beat this hobbled Miami Heat team that did not play well in the play-in. That came crashing back down. Nick Batum, 26 minutes, 3 points, minus 20 in those minutes. We talked about the Sixers bench getting completely outplayed by Bojan, by Robinson, and by Miles McBride. I'll be interested to see what the minutes breakdown is for the Knicks backcourt, especially because Tibbs opted to ride the hot hand with McBride for a lot of this game, and it worked out. I mean, he was 7 of 12 from the field, 5 of 7 from 3. But we're also used to Dante DiVincenzo playing 44 minutes a night. That's what we've been conditioned for over the last couple of months. And, you know, he rolled with McBride, and DiVincenzo ended up sitting a decent amount of this game.
I mean, I think that's just what you do with your Tibbs, because you're thinking, if one of these guys gets hot, we'll play the guy that gets hot, then the other guy will be fresher for the next game if it flips.
Yeah.
I mean, DiVincenzo, I don't think like DiVincenzo is I don't think this is going to be the minutes pattern necessarily for the rest of the season, but I think Tibbs was happy to do that if it was going that way.
Yeah, and Mitchell Robinson's the other one too, right? Which I was not prepared for a 30-minute Mitchell Robinson night.
He was great.
He looked fantastic. I mean, they have been very cautious with him. I don't know if it was coming back from the injury or if he had just, you know, kind of fallen out of favor, missing as much time as he had, but they were, you know, very, very careful with his workload. And then, you know, he ends up playing 30 minutes off the bench. Isaiah Hartenstein started and played only 18 minutes. We did not see any Precious Achiuwa. And knowing Tibbs, I think that will continue, and unless there's foul trouble, which of course there certainly could be going up against Embiid. Wouldn't be surprised if he works his way into the mix, but I think they're pretty happy with that top eight. Very much looking forward to game two in that series. That'll be at 7:30 p.m. Eastern tonight. All right, let's get back to the Saturday slate. And unfortunately, Alex, that means we have to talk about the LA Lakers and the Denver Nuggets. As you know, I'm for some reason aligned with the Lakers. I would have really liked to see the Lakers get off to a better start. Led this game at the half, you know, decent first half for LA. But the Nuggets just kind of did what they do, man. Third quarter onslaught came for the Lakers, 32-18. Was the score in the third quarter. It just turned into kind of a classic Denver win, man. And, you know, the D'Angelo Russell bubble may have finally burst.
Yeah, D'Lo goes 6 for 20 for 13 points. Only one turnover. You know, let's cut
one of nine for three here.
Yeah. This game confused me a little bit, partially because these teams have played so much. And somehow the Lakers just, they seem perplexed by the Jokic-Murray pick and roll. Perplexed. They have no interesting new way to guard it. They can't seem to stop it. And Denver basically did exactly what they wanted. Like all their starters played really well. KCP got his 4 threes in. Aaron Gordon caught a couple of lobs. And Anthony Davis went for 32. But there were some games, you know, last year where Anthony Davis would have a big performance and it just didn't seem to matter. Like it almost felt empty at times. And Jokic really wears him down. You know, I tweeted, which I don't do very often, because there was a clip going around of Anthony Davis with his hands on his knees at the end of a play. And it's funny to me watching the series. I think Nikola Jokic is in better shape than Anthony Davis. I don't know how to explain it. But he really tires Anthony Davis out in a way that Davis can't even get back up the court half the time.
No, you're right, man. I saw that clip going around as well. And, you know, the Lakers transition defense was brutal in this game. The Lakers point of attack defense was brutal. I don't know if there was a strategy as far as, you know, kind of operating to keep an eye on Jokic in the pick and roll, but they did not do a good job of that either. I did think LeBron was great, you know, in typical LeBron fashion, still gave you 27, 8, and 6. But, you know, 7 turnovers for LeBron was a little bit sloppy. I thought we'd see maybe a slightly more aggressive version of LeBron, which, you know, throughout his career in these game ones, he tends to kind of ease into a series, but you don't have that luxury against Denver, right? It's just not really an option. And I thought this reminded me a lot of game one of the West Finals last year when, as you mentioned, Anthony Davis went for 40 in game one. The Lakers felt like they played a pretty good game. Denver, you know, didn't play all that well. And yet, when it comes to late game execution, there's no team I trust more, not even the Celtics, than the Denver Nuggets when it comes to generating quality shots. And that's what they've done all year. That's what they did at the end of this one. I'd be a little concerned if I'm the Lakers because, again, I don't think Denver played all that well. You know, Jamal Murray, 9 of 24 from the field. He has dominated this Lakers matchup over the last couple of years. He was right there with Jokic as far as, you know, being the second best player in that series in the West Finals. I think we get a better effort in game two out of Jamal Murray. You know, KCP, 4 of 10 from three. I think you'll take that. And this was another game where I thought Denver made a lot of bones on the glass. We had 15 offensive rebounds. All we hear about is this Lakers size, 15 offensive boards for the Nuggets.
Yeah, they're not going to be able to, Lakers are not going to be able to win these games if they can't I mean, it's really hard to keep Jokic off the boards, and it's hard to keep guys like Aaron Gordon off the boards. But they have to provide some resistance somewhere, which they are not doing. No resistance on the boards, no resistance. Like, Denver was so comfortable running their offense all game. They only turned the ball over six times. They got looks that they liked. I think they even could have hit more shots than they did, and they got more fast break points and more points in the paint than the Lakers. You can't do that. You're just impossible to win a series if that continues.
Yeah. I never thought the Lakers were going to win this series. Denver, by the way, is -650 to win the series outright. That's the third lowest odds. Boston's -20,000 to beat the Miami Heat. We'll talk about that one in a bit. Yeah, that's outrageous. OKC -1,200 to beat the Pelicans. That was actually a fun game one last night. But yeah, goes without saying, Lakers got to win game two. I don't think that's going to happen. But I don't know if you can go down 0-2 and tell yourself that you got to win for the next five, you know, against this Nuggets team. They are 7.5-point dogs going into tonight. Total is up at 223.5. I think the other thing, I mean, psychologically, it's like in the first round, it shouldn't feel this urgent. You know, if you're the Lakers, like LeBron, he's not used to having to go this hard in round one. It's like he eases himself into series, eases himself into the playoffs. It's like you almost have to have this like NBA finals mentality right off the bat, which I think is a tough switch to flip if you're the Lakers.
I think it is. You know, I was listening to the Redick and LeBron podcast, Mind the Game, which I've been enjoying. And they were talking about the playoffs, and they were talking about game ones and how a lot of game ones are like the guys, the coaches just tell you go out there and play your game. We'll adjust for game two. I don't think you can do that if you're the Lakers in this game one. Not only that, you've seen this. You just saw this team. You see them a ton during the regular season. They've had your number. This is not like a just go out and play your game and we'll figure it out in game two situation. This is like, no, game one, you got to come out with some game plan that is new and interesting, which they did not do.
Yeah, felt like they had an opportunity. I mean, you're up 8 at the end of the first. You're still up 5 at the half. And, you know, letting that slip away in the third quarter, I think, will in all likelihood be something we look back on when this series is over. But who knows, man? I mean, Lakers could come out and win this game tonight. All of a sudden, it's 1-1, heading back to L.A. and the narrative completely flips. If you want to bet the Lakers, by the way, to win the series, you could get them at +425, which, I don't know, 4-1. I don't know if I'm taking that. I think Denver probably wins this thing in five. Let's get to the Sunday slate. We did see all eight home teams win on Saturday and Sunday, and that continued in the early window Sunday. Celtics just stomped all over the Miami Heat. Final score was nowhere near as indicative of what this game really was. Boston ends up winning by 20. I mean, this was one that got completely out of hand in the third quarter. And honestly, about what you'd expect, right? I mean, you give Miami the benefit of the doubt because of their history against teams like Boston and, you know, the coaching of Eric Spoelstra. But personnel-wise, Boston looked like the better team. Boston looked like the team that has, you know, the best five-man unit in the NBA by a mile. And, you know, Miami, without Jimmy Butler, it's really hard to see them climb back into the series. And even with Jimmy Butler, man, I do wonder if the Miami Heat devil magic has finally run its course.
Yeah, Miami played like a very valiant first quarter. We'll give them that. They played a respectable first quarter. No, man. As soon as they went to a zone, I was like, you're going to play a zone against a five out team? How is that going to work? You can't do that. I don't even know how much I had to take away from this game. I mean, Sam Hauser absolutely annihilated them. Yeah. I don't even feel like the Celtics were trying necessarily that hard. It just felt so easy for them. I don't have that many takes.
They're -20,000 to win the series for a reason. I'm with you on that. They are -15-point favorites at home for game one, which will come to us on Wednesday night. Celtics played eight guys and seven of them hit multiple threes. And the lone outlier was Jason Tatum, who went 1 of 8 from beyond the arc. The Celtics, especially in a series like this, just have so much room for error, right? And I think that is the inherent benefit of having a healthy Porzingis, having Derek White, having Drew Holiday. You look at some of these other teams that are one or two guys and then everybody else, or a team like Phoenix that's three guys and then a huge drop off. Boston, especially against a team like Miami, you can have two or maybe even three of your top five guys not be on it, not have their A game on a given night, and you're still going to have a really good chance to win that game. I mean, they're so deep. They're built so well for these situations. And I don't see this team having any trouble certainly getting through this series or even the next series, right? I mean, their path to the Eastern Conference Finals, whoever's waiting for them there. I mean, this should be a team that drops 0-1 games over the first two rounds.
Yeah. I mean, this version of the Heat without Butler, you know, Drew Holiday would be like their third best offensive option by a lot. And he's practically an afterthought in Boston's right. offense. This should be a sweep.
We're heading toward a sweep. I mean, it wouldn't be shocking if Miami pulled something out, you know, in their home court, but I think you're right. It should be a sweep. All right. Maybe the single most shocking result for me over the weekend, the Clippers taking it to the Dallas Mavericks, 109-97. That is the Kawhi Leonard-less LA Clippers. And they will hope to get Kawhi back for game two. We will see. I think, you know, winning game one, much in the way as we'll talk about in a moment with Milwaukee Bucks, you know, feels like it maybe buys you a little bit more cushion, but Kawhi is going to practice today. We'll get an update after that. I think he should have a reasonable chance to get back for game two. I'm not panicking on Dallas. I'll say that. I mean, this was a shockingly poor showing for basically everybody but Luka Doncic and Kyrie Irving, who, you know, ended up both scoring 30 plus, but it was, you know, kind of a dirty 30 plus. You look at the series price right now, it hasn't shifted as dramatically as these other series, right? Like Milwaukee's minus 225 all of a sudden to win their series against Indiana. Clippers are only minus 150. Dallas still hanging around at plus 125. This to me, we saw a couple teams survive bad shooting nights, bad offensive nights, and still get wins. You know, think about a team like the Knicks. Dallas was on the other end of that. I mean, this was a horrendous offensive performance for a team that had been so good, so cohesive, so consistent over the last couple of months. I would like to try to view this one as an anomaly, but I think you, especially if Kawhi's back for game two, it feels like the Mavs might have blown a pretty huge opportunity to take control.
This was a big opportunity. And I think it was a combination of, I think the Clippers came out with a really good game plan and not necessarily like a surprising or shocking game plan, which is just like, we're going to try to make anybody else besides Doncic and Kyrie touch the ball. You know, we're going to trap these guys and off picks and stuff like that. And it was Doncic's first half. I mean, it was Kyrie's second half. I mean, like you mentioned, they got their points. It was pretty dirty though. And it, nobody else on Dallas was really capable of going out there and making stuff happen offensively. And I do think the Clippers, for what it's worth, made some really tough shots at the end of the game. Tough shots, not just at the end of the game, but throughout the whole game. And, you know, if those are a little more even, that's the thing about the NBA. You know, you make like, let's say you make three really tough threes, that's 9 points. All of a sudden this game is basic. It's like a close game. It's a one possession game. Right. So I'd be fairly comfortable picking the Mavericks to win game two, especially if Kawhi is not there.
I think that's the big swing piece, obviously, is Kawhi Leonard, and maybe more importantly, what Kawhi looks like. Dallas is a 2.5-point favorite for game two right now. So I think that probably moves if we get news that Kawhi's in tomorrow night. But either way, I don't think people are necessarily jumping off the Mavs. I'm not doing that quite yet. You said exactly what I was going to say about the tough shots. I mean, Paul George hit a couple really, really difficult shots late in the game. James Harden, one of the better postseason games we've ever seen from him, you know, especially in this spot with no Kawhi. You're always kind of wondering, how does James Harden show up in a spot like this? I mean, 28 points, 6 of 11 from 3, 8 assists for him as well. Clippers didn't really turn the ball over. It was only Russ who had 4 turnovers. Everybody else was pretty clean. And like you said, I mean, Kyrie and Luka got their numbers. They were able to kind of force Dallas back into the game late. You know, they outscored the Clippers by 11 in the fourth quarter, but they got almost nothing out of PJ Washington. Daniel Gafford had this very strange quote after the game where he's like, yeah, I felt like I was just running around out there. I got to be better. Like, yeah, man, that's exactly what it felt like. He did nothing in his 14 minutes. You know, Tim Hardaway Jr. has kind of been on a slow decline, really since midseason. He's given them nothing. Like the bench completely evaporated for Dallas. You know, the Exum, Lively, Hardaway, Maxi Kleber played a ton of minutes for some reason. He was not good either. But I still think the Mavs have a decent chance here. If you're asking me like what series, like where's the buying opportunity now that odds have shifted, I think I would say Dallas at plus 125.
Yeah, I think that's fine. I mean, I don't think like Jason Kidd's an offensive mastermind, but I think you can look at this tape and probably figure out, you know, some stuff to do, especially because a lot of what the Clippers did defensively again was just a lot of trapping and really hard hedging and just being really aggressive on ball handlers. So you got to just, you know, put home some points to the role players on where to be, essentially where to be and where to look when you catch the ball. And I think it'll be a more competitive game.
Yeah, I think so too. And again, we'll get game two of that series on Tuesday night. You can hear us breaking it down on NBA Radio, 7 p.m. Eastern tomorrow, over on SiriusXM NBA. Dallas had a 106 offensive rating, by the way, in that game one, which not as bad as I was expecting, to be honest. But, you know, based on where they've been sitting over the last couple of months, would think that'll improve. All right, the whole podcast has been building to this. Pacers-Bucks, Alex, you and I were very nervous. Everybody I talked to sitting here in Milwaukee was nervous. This was not like I was sitting down watching the game with my wife and she's like, why isn't anybody coming over? Like, what did you guys talk about doing anything? I'm like, for one, it's 6 o'clock on a Sunday and you know, it's a Sunday. If it's 6 o'clock on Saturday, maybe. I'm like, two, nobody's excited for this. Like everybody's just kind of dreading this game. Like I think everybody wants to be in a solitary environment where we have no idea how this is going to go. I think it'd be too far to say this was a best case start to the series for Milwaukee because I think the Bucks did leave a lot on the table. Bizarre game from Dame, who obviously had his best first half for sure of the season, maybe for the last few seasons, 35 in the first half, scoreless in the second half. I saw some people, you know, screenshotting some bets last night of like, oh, I had Damian Lillard leading scorer in the game. Pascal Siakam actually was the leading scorer at 36, or people who jumped on that live line thinking he was going to get a 40 or a 50 piece. We apologize. But I think the biggest question we had for Milwaukee specifically was, okay, no Giannis. This is why you bring Damian Lillard onto this roster. Not because you thought Giannis would be hurt, but because you need somebody to, you know, basically be able to carry your offense in a situation like this. And that's exactly what Dame did. I mean, the Bucks did not really play all that well. I thought, especially in the first half, threes were not falling for either team. I believe Indy started 0 of 12 from beyond the arc before they started getting a handful of those to fall in the second half. But, you know, the Bucks were up, you know, 15 to 20 for most of the second quarter and into the third. It honestly to me felt like it should have been more because Indy could not hit anything. I think the Bucks did what they needed to do defensively. You give a lot of credit to Milwaukee for that. Pacers did miss a lot of open threes. But I don't know that this is necessarily an indication of how I would expect game two to go. Like you can't pencil Dame in for 35 in the first half. It was still a little concerning to me that Milwaukee came out flat outside of Lillard offensively. But either way, if you're Milwaukee, You went into these first two games and we absolutely have to get one without Giannis. And now if you could find a way to win game two, you're sitting in a nice spot. That gives Giannis the potential cushion to, you know, maybe sit out game three and really let that calf get to where it needs to be.
Yeah. And some of the, first of all, Dame was great. We have to say that. I mean, Dame in that first half looked like Portland Dame. Like when you're watching him in Portland, yes. He was taking over games by himself. It was like, man, this is what we signed up for. And I wish he played with that confidence and that aggression when Giannis was also in, which has been a problem.
Right.
You mentioned it, like the game didn't feel to me as certain as it should have, partially because the third quarter, Indiana remembered that they were really good and that they had Bucks number all season. They came out flying, pushing the ball in transition the third quarter. They had 5 offensive rebounds in the third quarter and just really turned up the energy. And like, it wasn't there for them in the fourth, but if you're them, I think you may have discovered something in that third quarter, which you can take into game two. And I have to get, you know, I also have to give the Bucks a little bit of credit. Doc Rivers, a little bit of credit for trying something interesting on defense, which is just putting Brook Lopez on Pascal Siakam rather than Miles Turner, because Siakam is less of a 3-point threat. Now Siakam had a great game.
Yeah.
So we'll see if the Bucks stick with that, because I guess to some extent, if you're Milwaukee, you'd rather have Siakam take 25 shots than Halliburton get off. And Halliburton was just not good at all in this game.
I wouldn't even say he wasn't good. He just wasn't impactful. I think if you're Indiana with no Mathurin, with the bench unit that you're rolling out there, you can't have Tyrese Halliburton take 7 shots in 38 minutes and TJ McConnell take twice as many. You know, I mean, I think it was one singular possession where McConnell missed 2 just wide open threes, right? Where you can almost hear the Milwaukee crowd goading him into it. Like, yeah, shoot it, dude, shoot it. And you could tell McConnell did not want to do that. But at that point, Indy was so desperate for offense that, you know, that's kind of what they had to resort to. I mean, Miles Turner was terrible in this game, 5 of 17 from the field. I think the decision to put Lopez on Siakam, you look at the result in terms of what Siakam did and you say, I don't know if that really worked, but I think it forced Miles Turner to feel like he needed to do more than he probably is capable of doing. And I think that ended up working out to the Bucks' benefit. But again, I think you're going into game two saying, all right, they're not going to start 0 of 12 from three. They gave us a gift by shooting that poorly early on. And like you said, this was a 12-point game going into the fourth quarter. I mean, we were on the verge of this turning into a complete laugher. I think the Bucks were up as much as 27 at one point before Indiana started turning it on in the third. But we also have to mention how Milwaukee kind of secured this game, right? I mean, there were some nervous moments as that fourth quarter started. First possession, Chris Middleton, pull up three, makes it. Next possession, Bobby Portis, and one layup. All of a sudden, the lead's back up to 16, and you felt like Milwaukee had that cushion again.
Yeah, I think this was more than anything. I think this was the experience of the Bucks going up against the inexperience of most of these Pacers players. Now, Siakam has a lot of playoff experience, and yeah. I think that showed. He was not afraid of the moment at all, played with confidence. The rest of the guys, however, on this team, the core of the team has virtually no real playoff experience. And the Bucks, you know, part of the problem is that they're old, but also almost all the guys on this roster have made deep playoff runs or have been key pieces like Lillard on shallower playoff runs. So this moment, you know, if you call game one against the Indiana Pacers a moment, this sort of moment is not, this is just like a walk in the park for them, you know?
Yeah. One more takeaway for me is that Chris Middleton looked great. And this was the best, I think, overall performance, especially given the stakes that we've seen from Middleton in a while. Obviously, the Bucks have been very careful with him throughout the year. But I actually thought, I mean, Lillard played 38 minutes. It felt like less to me. Like there were long stretches where he was off the floor. And you're thinking, man, as hot as he is and without Giannis, like this should be a game where he's playing 44 minutes. And, you know, they were pretty comfortable, you know, running things through Chris Middleton. And it worked out. I mean, he was plus 25 in 35 minutes, 9 of 14 from the field, just hitting some of those classic, you know, Chris Middleton back shoulder fadeaway type of shots, 10 rebounds as well, 4 assists for Middleton. Milwaukee played very well. I still think, I think certainly Indiana believes that they could play better and they will play better. I think Milwaukee did leave a decent amount on the table in terms of 3-point shooting as well. So Indiana's not going to start 0 of 12, but Pat Connaughton missed a couple wide open threes. Malik Beasley airballed a wide open three. I think it was early in the second quarter. AJ Green got his customary, like, you know, they just throw him out there for half a quarter. And like, anytime you touch the ball, you got to shoot it. He went 0 for 3 on some pretty good looks. So yeah, you're a little concerned about Indiana's shooting coming around, but I think the Bucks left some on the table as well. But either way, Milwaukee off to a good start here in what felt like a pretty dicey game one. Bucks are 1.5-point favorites for game two. 225.5 is the total. All right, let's conclude with Pelicans Thunder. That was in the late window last night. Very strange game. For a lot of it, I thought the New Orleans Pelicans were going to win this game. I think OKC survived the game that they probably should have lost. And I do think they'll look much better. I think they'll be in control of the series. I don't know, 12-1 or plus or minus 1200, excuse me, for the Thunder to win the series feels a little bit steep based on how they looked last night, but they're unquestionably the better team. And again, I felt like they got blitzed. That's probably a game they should have lost. And to survive that, I feel like puts them in a pretty good spot now going forward.
Yeah, and I think the main reason the Pelicans were in this game was the main reason that you would have assumed the Pelicans would be in this game, or really a reason a lot of teams would be, they out-rebounded the Thunder. The Thunder are not a good rebounding team. Chet Holmgren is partially responsible for that with his frame, but Valanciunas goes for 20 boards, 9 of which were offensive. Obviously, that's huge. Pelicans get 18 offensive boards. Look, Ingram didn't play that well. I mean, I think that's what you kind of come back with if you're Pelicans. It's like, yeah, we probably let this one get away, but Ingram's going to play better at some point. I think Trey Murphy can continue playing at the level that he played at. He's been really good all season. And I was kind of conflicted on how much I think missing Zion actually matters. Because I did VEASAN the other day before the Kings game. The Kings playing game. When I picked the Pelicans, I just said, I don't really think it matters that much as Zion's out. Zion had a great game, but when he's not out there, they're better defensively for sure. And it simplifies their offense. They have more floor spacers. They don't have to deal with like putting two on Zion and built the other team building a wall. I don't want to say it's not a factor for me in the series, but I think they could certainly have potential to win the series without him.
I don't see the Pels winning the series necessarily, partially because I think Ingram just is not himself. You know, I mean, he's been downright terrible in these three games since he's come back. And, you know, 5 of 17 last night. Herb Jones struggled as well. I mean, basically all the shots were threes, so it's going to be a little bit hit or miss with him. Pelicans had a bunch of turnovers as well. That didn't help. But I do think not having Zion makes things a little more cut and dry when it comes to Valanciunas. You know, they used him very strangely down the stretch, right? If you're a Valanciunas fantasy manager, it was kind of a disaster, right? He played 11 minutes one night, 25 the next, 12 the next, 30 the next. And this is a matchup, I think, where Valanciunas is going to be a problem for OKC. He was a major problem. 9 offensive boards of those 20 last night, and he felt every single one of them. I just, you know, with Zion, like, who guards it? Like, for what? I mean, not many teams have a Zion type of body, right? Somebody who you feel good throwing on him. But, you know, Valanciunas gives the Thunder problems. I think Zion would give them similar issues. He's not the same type of volume rebounder that Valanciunas is, but, you know, I think asking Lou Dort or Jalen Williams to be the guy who's just kind of standing there, letting Zion pound into him over and over. I don't know if the Thunder really have that guy.
Yeah, but I mean, the series would be way more interesting with Zion, and I think the Pelicans' ceiling's higher. But yeah, they could try Dort. They could try big Jalen Williams. You have Holmgren play weak side, go for the blocks all the time. But yeah, look, I think this series could be won on the bench potentially. You know, the Thunder are not getting anything out of Gordon Hayward. You know, they got some nice stuff out of like Cason Wallace and Isaiah Joe. Those guys have done what they've done all year. But, you know, Larry Nance had a pretty nice game, and Najee Marshall always comes in with energy. Alvarado. I think OKC is going to win the series. I agree with you that I don't think they should be minus 1,200 favorites. Because this Pelicans team, even without Zion, is very good. And I think people are overrating how much Zion's absence matters. And it's not all about number. Like, he has a minus 4 net rating this season. The Pelicans are 4 points worse when Zion's on the court. It's not all about that. Like I mentioned, it's the simplification of both sides of the ball when Zion is out there. Or not.
Pelicans 7-1 to win the series, if you think that is a possibility, by the way, over at DraftKings. You mentioned Trey Murphy. He played well, 5 threes. I mean, I absolutely love Trey Murphy. I still think he's wildly undervalued. Maybe not in like the fantasy world or people that are super clued in, but it's like, does the average NBA fan have any idea who Trey Murphy is? Like, I feel like he's like the next McCall Bridges to me. Like, there's going to be a team that, like, he's either going to be like a super valuable third guy, or he's going to be tragically like overpaid and asked to do more than he should. Hopefully it doesn't go the Bridges in Brooklyn route. But I absolutely love Trey Murphy. And I think when he came in here, just like, all right, he's, you know, guy shot like 47% from three at Virginia. Like, he'll just be a spot up guy. Like, he is so much more than that. You know, super athletic, super good on the defensive end, long arms. He was great last night. You mentioned the bench, and I think the minutes breakdown for OKC is really interesting. You do not often see any team in the modern NBA in a close game that was within like 5 points, it felt like both ways the whole night, play 11 guys. Like, this this is not like when you look at the Celtics, like, oh, they kind of emptied the bench in the fourth quarter. It's like OKC was mixing in 11 guys, six different players off this bench played meaningful minutes. Jalen Williams, Gordon Hayward, Kendrick Williams, Isaiah Joe, Aaron Wiggins. And then the rookie Cason Wallace, who closed this game for the Thunder and had a huge defensive possession on CJ McCollum.
Well, Cason Wallace he's great. To me, he and, you know, I thought Hayward would be better, to be honest, just in general, when he got to the Thunder, because I thought part of the Thunder's plan was, we're not sure if Giddey can play in fourth quarters in the playoffs, like last 6 minutes of games, but maybe Gordon Hayward can, and maybe Cason Wallace can. And I think Cason Wallace absolutely can. And so I think he's going to be a big swing piece. I don't think it was I don't know. Maybe some of the reason for Daigneault was, look, we have a really young team. We got to make sure that anybody we might use in this series gets the cobwebs out, gets the nerves out in game one, right? I don't want to throw, you know, Isaiah Joe into like game two randomly when we need him. After he didn't get his nerves out in game one. So I think that was a fine decision by them.
Yeah. And they did some offense defense at the end. You know, they were kind of alternating Cason Wallace and Isaiah Joe, but Giddey did not play in the final 10 minutes. He checked out right around the 10 minute mark. And that was it. Only played 20 minutes on the night. So I agree with it, right? It's like, what is Josh Giddey bringing you in the final 6 minutes of a playoff game that you're not getting from, you know, specifically SGA and Jalen Williams, right? And you have this ace defender in Cason Wallace. You have this ace 3-point shooter in Isaiah Joe. So I think that's the thing that stands out when you look at the minutes, you know, for the starters. Like everybody is, you know, 30 plus, 35 plus, and then there's Giddey at 20. I would not be surprised if that continues, you know, for this series and beyond.
Giddey, for a while, I mean, especially this season, has felt kind of like the odd man out in the Thunder's rebuild. I just don't. He makes more sense as like a guy. He doesn't play the same way necessarily, but he feels more like a supercharged, like TJ McConnell type, where it's like he should be hanging out with the second unit, you know, let SGA and Jalen Williams get some breaks as ball handlers once in a while. Like, get that. But I think he could just continue to get played off the floor in a decent amount of these playoff games. Yeah. And I haven't even looked. I probably don't even have the numbers up. I'll be interested to see like what his props are for game two, whether the books have really adjusted, thinking like Giddey might do nothing this whole series.
Well, I can try to give you an answer on that. His points prop for game two at DraftKings right now is 9.5.
I was going to say 8.5. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's more about the, I mean, you know, I don't think they need him. I just don't think they need him. Like you said, you have the three-pointers with Isaiah Joe. You have the defense with Cason Wallace. I don't think you necessarily need Giddey's playmaking at all. So we'll see how this develops.
All right, I'm going to put out an alert that we're definitely overreacting to just one game. But if you're the Clippers or the Mavs, are you feeling pretty good about a potential OKC matchup in round two?
I think you were always feeling pretty decent about it. Just because of the inexperience. I don't think this team would, this game one would have necessarily changed their minds about it.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we'll end on this. And again, you can hear more from us. We'll preview all three of the games tonight. Go check us out on NBA Radio Sirius XM, 7 p.m. Eastern tonight. We'll give you all of our thoughts, betting advice, everything for Magic, Cavs, Sixers, Knicks, and Lakers Nuggets. I just want to go rapid fire through these series because I don't think we put our official predictions on the book. So we have the advantage now of seeing one game in every series. So we'll go series by series here. I will ask you for a winner and a number of games. So we will start with the Magic and the Cavaliers. What say you?
I'm going to say Cavs in 5.
Okay. I'm with you on that. Cavs in 5. I think we've really made an effort to talk about this series as much as we can. There's nothing else to say. Cavs in 5. Sixers, Knicks.
I think Knicks in 6.
Yeah. Knicks in 6. Okay. Mm-hmm. I don't want to, that's what I have written down as well. But I don't want to match you on all these. I'm going to say Knicks in 5. I've been okay. Hard on the Knicks for this whole series. I don't think they played well in game one. I think they got away with it. I don't know that the Sixers are going to play a whole lot better. You got an banged up Embiid. You have an ill Tyrese Maxey coming into game two. I mean, if they're down 0-2 going back to Philly, yeah, it's an advantage to play at home, but that's also a crowd that's going to turn on you if you're down 10 in the second quarter. It's going to be a nervous Philly crowd. I think the Knicks win game two, and I think they could take that in 5. So you say Knicks in 6, I'll say Knicks in 5. Lakers, Nuggets.
I'm going to go Nuggets in, I think Nuggets in 5.
Okay. I'm going Nuggets in 4. I'm going Nuggets in 4. Oh, I just, okay. I think the Lakers, I wouldn't say they gave their best shot, but they gave a pretty good shot in game one. And I think this was a stark reminder that the Nuggets have the Lakers number. The Lakers could play really, really well and still lose games to Denver, as they did for most of the Western Conference Finals last year. It's not like the Lakers just laid down. Like, the Lakers played a pretty great series and just got beat straight up. And yeah, it's certainly more likely than not that they'll win one game in this series. But I don't, if it doesn't come, you know, against the Nuggets in game two, I think this Lakers team could kind of start to fold in on itself a little bit. I don't know that this is the 2016 Cavs, you know, we'll rally back and win this series type of mentality. I don't know if the Lakers really have that, and I could see this getting away from them. So I think the Nuggets win in the sweep. I do. Suns, Timberwolves.
I originally picked Suns, but I think I might flip-flop.
Ooh.
I did think this was a very crucial game one. I think you may have asked me what the most important game one was in a different podcast, and I think we both kind of identified this one. I can't remember. We definitely talked about it. So the fact that Timberwolves came out, they won like they did, kind of alarming to me. Yeah. As someone who originally picked the Suns, so I'm gonna pivot.
Okay.
And I'm gonna pivot the Wolves in seven.
Okay. I'm gonna do the same, and I don't know if I had an official pick on the record for this one, so I don't know if I can say I had the benefit of not backtracking, but I think I would have leaned Suns. I was sympathetic to the Suns being favorites and very skeptical of what the Timberwolves, you know, mentally would be capable of. And I think winning that game the way they did gives them a pretty nice cushion here. Even if you lose game two, I still think you're at least not against the ropes. So yeah, I'll go Wolves in seven. I think if this gets to a seven game, it would obviously be in Minneapolis, and that's a game they can win at home. Pacers Bucks.
I'm gonna go Bucks in seven. I do. I was not so scared off. I don't know. I think the Pacers could still make this a competitive series.
Oh yeah.
If the Pacers had won game one, I probably would have told you Pacers in seven, but the fact that Dame looks so good, so confident, I think that can carry over. So I'm gonna go Bucks in seven.
Okay. I'll do Bucks in six. I would not be surprised if this is a 2-2 series in some form or fashion after four games. But I think if the Bucks could buy Giannis enough time that he's back and there's no workload concerns, there's no re-injury concerns, I think they could turn it on at the end of the series and win it in six. So I fully expect, I think you and I both do, that the Pacers claw their way back into the series. But you will say Bucks in seven. I'll say Bucks in six. That brings us to Mavericks Clippers.
Yeah, I think I still want to back the Mavericks here, but I have some concerns. So I will go Mavericks in seven.
Okay. I'm doing the same. I'm too pot committed on the Mavericks. This would be an all-time reversal if I just bailed after one game. I was so in on Dallas winning game one. Like, that was part of the thinking. I'm like, no, Kawhi, they can't lose this game. And then they do. And oh man, if Kawhi comes back, it's going to be dicey, but I can't backtrack on this one. Dallas in seven. I think they can pull it off. All right. Heat Celtics.
Sweep. Celtics sweep.
Yep. Celtics in four and Pelicans Thunder.
I'm going to go OKC in six. I think the Pelicans can get two games. I think they could win both games at home.
I'm going to say OKC in five. I don't disagree with you, but I think game one was one of the wins for the Pelicans, and sure, they didn't get it. You know, it's yeah. I think that was, if you're kind of plotting out, like, where do they come? I think that was a game that they on paper should have won. And I'm not saying the Pelicans played all that well necessarily, but, you know, to basically be, what was it, tie game with like 20 seconds left. If you're the underdog as the eight seed, like, you have to win that game, and they didn't find a way to do it. So I think that is, like, mentally, that's a tough one to come back from, to be that close, to have the advantage, to, I wouldn't say you're not putting OKC on the ropes, but you're putting a really inexperienced team that I think everybody is excited about, but also reasonably skeptical about as far as one seeds go. You know, you're putting them in a tough spot, dropping that game one. And I think you allow doubt to creep in if you're OKC and you lose that. So I think the Pelicans blew a big opportunity. I think they take another game, but I will say Pelicans in five. All right, that'll do it for today's show. I will be back tomorrow afternoon with our guy, Kieran Sprecher. So we'll be recapping all three games tonight. We'll start previewing the three games tomorrow. It'll be myself and Brandon Kravitz on Wednesday. We'll have Dr. A and Rick Kambla on Thursday. And Alex, the Friday pod, officially done now, right? We're not talking fantasy playoffs, waiver wire?
Officially done. We may do a pop-in once in a while, if something happens, you know, maybe something Celtics related, who knows? But officially, yeah, officially no regular Friday show.
Yeah, and Ken has fled to New Zealand. Is that correct?
He has fled to New Zealand. Yes.
Okay. All right. Well, hopefully we'll get him back stateside at some point. Maybe we could do a travel log podcast with Ken Kreitz once he gets back. But yeah, we'll still be doing four shows a week throughout the NBA playoffs. You can catch us here. Catch us on the YouTube, RotoWire NBA YouTube page. Of course, RotoWire NBA and RotoWire on Twitter. Make sure you check out Prize Picks. We mentioned it at the top of the show. They are the presenting sponsor of the pod. Use that promo code ROTOPOD, ROTOPOD. That'll get you a 100% deposit match over on Prize Picks.